Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. I have an exciting show lined up for tonight. We're joined by Carrie. How do you pronounce your last name? Bernor?
Bernor, yes.
And, well, Carrie has an exciting story to tell us today. And, Carrie, I've been reading over your website and your history and your case, and you were a former, or you are, a former Catholic nun.
Exactly.
And how did you decide, you know, this is obviously a long process and a lot to unwrap here over the next hour, but how did you become an ex-nun?
Well, that was a process. It was a process to become a nun. And so basically I converted from being brought up quasi-Protestant, but not necessarily in any faith. And due to being very attracted to the Roman Catholic Church in high school, and I immediately thereafter became a nun within one month of my having been brought into the Roman Catholic Church. And from there, I lived on in the convent for about 5 years in Still River, Massachusetts. You can find my name in the directory under Sister Benjamin Bernor, 1996, 97, and 98. I'm in the Catholic directory in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is the official publication that indicates who is a nun in the diocese. And then from there, I was, we lived on the farm. We did organic farming and so forth. And after that point, I felt a calling to go more into a hermit type of a lifestyle. And I had the blessing of my superiors to do that. And so I left, and in order to become a hermit, you have to prove that you're going to live the life out. So I moved back to Spencer, Massachusetts in 1998, started to pursue that path. And within 2.5 years of my pursuing that path, a certain priest ends up grabbing my left breast in confession, in a confessional. Now, that's not a big deal compared to what other people go through. But in my case, I was absolutely stunned because it's completely opposite of what I was pursuing. So the whole thing ended up, I tried to keep it out of the courts. It ended up going into the court, unfortunately. And of course, if you want to find that out, that whole entire story is called Divine Challenge. And the book is available now. It's available by hardcover at this point. We're still working on Kindle. But this is called Divine Challenge: The Clergy, Sex Abuse of a Hermit Nun, and its 15-year cover-up by a monastery and church officials, and that's what it looks like. And so hopefully you'll be able to find that. Hashtag Divine Challenge should get you directly to the page. We've been intercepted heavily, and that's why I apologize for being a little bit late here. My entire computer and everything got really messed up today, so I apologize. So basically, at this stage, the matter goes to court, and I ended up having to change the trial date so that I could have witnesses come forward. And the morning of, they changed the judges. They had allowed the abbey, the monastery where this matter took place — this was under spiritual direction at the monastery, St. Joseph's Abbey in Spencer, Massachusetts. And so basically, the case was foiled, and the priest was acquitted. His name was Father Joseph Chukong. So when I did more research into the situation, I found out that there were other victims. First, another one came forward, a friend of mine, Sister Mari Malouf. She told me that someone else, that happened to her by the same priest. And then in the course of 7 years, I found out that basically the monastery was a big sex ring, and that there was more than one victim, and more than just me, more than just Miriam. It was actually a plethora of several different kinds of victims, ranging from vulnerable adults who were sexually abused in their childhoods, involving satanic ritualistic abuse, and the list and the laundry goes on and on. So when I realized that this is not a one-time problem, this priest is not just he's a symptom of a problem that's bigger than that. So I went to go into deeper research and found out, okay, there's some underpinnings here that that tie into Vatican politics and into Massachusetts and into the bigger picture as to what these effects are having on our country, when our country basically was essentially, I go into this in heavy detail on my recent International Tribunal of Natural Justice. I actually did a testimony, and that's on YouTube right now. And I go into the entire plan about how the Jesuits basically took over our infrastructure. They took over our judicial systems, our, you know, on every single level, our banking, our economy. You know, they did this by way of bringing in their universities from the very beginning. And it's interesting, if you look into the history, you'll find that Samuel Morse actually condemned the Vatican and said that we would never have diplomatic ties with them. And then upon Reagan's coming in the 1980s, he opened up diplomatic relations. And so America was laid waste big time as a result of that. So
interesting.
Other people get into this who are far more adept, like Kay Griggs. She gets into this. She was married to a colonel. And the colonel, when he would go on drunken tirades with her, he would expose the whole entire thing about how this whole thing is actually, this is embedded deep within the fabric of our military and armed forces and so forth, how they control them.
And you, you've also read the work of Eric John Phelps, correct?
Absolutely.
Now,
yes.
Early on, I was turned on to his work, and I kind of just dismissed it at the time because I saw so much more evidence for a Zionist influence. But now I've been wondering if there's been a sort of a bait and switch there, and the same thing I think with Islam has gone on too. So I've been rethinking that. We see Islam had attacked Europe more than 500 times before the Crusades, you know, so we attacked them 12 times, but they had invaded Europe 500 times, even got all the way up into Iceland and Ireland and captured, you know, millions of slaves up there. And so all of this history has been suppressed, and you're not supposed to talk about Islam at all. And all of the focus has been on Israel and on Zionism, and I'm wondering if that isn't a red herring type of situation. I've been thinking that for the last several weeks. We've been doing a series on Islam as well with Lloyd DeYoung, and we're going to finish that up, I hope, next week. But militarily, strategically speaking, there would be reason for a bait and switch type situation, so I'm not completely against the idea. So since you and I started talking, it's been more than a month, I think, emailing, and then with my series on Islam, I've been going, oh gosh, I'm going to have to go through and reread or go back through all of Eric John Phelps' work. And then there's Johnny Carlucci's books on this topic as well. So I'm thinking I'm going to have to dig into his books and figure out this whole thing with the Jesuits. So let me ask you, how long were you a nun?
I was a nun total in the community and as a hermit for 14 years total.
Wow, as a hermit too. So I've got some notes here, and it says, I converted to Roman Catholicism when I was 17 years old. Shortly after, moved into the covenant at St. Benedict Center, Still River, Massachusetts in 1993. I served God and the covenant for 6 years before moving forward with my commitment to become a hermit nun in the Diocese of Worcester, Massachusetts. So how does one, that's a huge step because we're social animals. So how does one decide to be a hermit nun?
In my case, it was a very strong calling. It's not for negating the world. It's actually to separate oneself from the world and give service, a life of service by prayer, by praying for the world. And the monks of old would kind of, in the desert fathers, they would talk about it, that it's basically when one monk offers their life that way and it's in total alignment with God and it's beautiful and it's all, not someone running from a crime or doing something like that, but someone who's genuinely a monk, that it actually raises basically the consciousness of all mankind when someone does that. So it's an offering, it's a gift.
Now, go ahead.
No. And so because my story is so intense, I'm just giving big broad strokes, especially if we're only gonna cover this in an hour. So
We can go extra if you need, by the way.
Okay, good, good. Okay. So basically at this stage in the game, I ended up realizing that the newspaper wanted, I picked up files from the DA's office that they were suppressing for 8 months. And when I received the files, I basically said to the clerk, I said, "Do you know why you were told not to give me these files?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Do you want me to show you?" So I opened up the files wherein, prior to my having gone to court in this criminal court case against the priest that grabbed my chest, basically the monastery admitted that this was a pattern, that this did in fact happen, and that this did happen to the woman that I mentioned earlier, this woman named Miriam, who I later found out about. And so the district attorney's office was doing everything they could to not allow me to have that documentation because they were afraid that I would go into a civil suit and actually be able to win, because in a civil suit, you prove 51%, you're good to go. So at this stage, I went to the Spencer New Leader on my way back home, and I dropped off a file, not everything, just a part of it. And they called me when I got home on my landline. I didn't have a cell phone back then. And the gentleman, when I met with him face to face, his name is David Dorr from the Spencer New Leader, wonderful person. He basically said, "Did you speak with anyone within the first 20 minutes of our having arranged this meeting together?" And I said, "You know, I had to wait about an hour and a half for everybody to get home, like my sister." He said, "Well, I just want to caution you to not use your phone. Your phone is tapped. I received a phone call from St. Joseph's Abbey threatening to kill me if I publish your story." Wow. That's when everything changed on me. That's when things went from a boob grab to, what the heck is this about? What am I a part of? I don't understand how, if it's just a boob grab, why can't they just fix it? Why can't they just not have the priest work with women? That's all I was asking for. But they needed to use my case as a feature case so that the other victims would not come forward. They were afraid that others would come forward if somehow I won in that case. So at that point, I realized, I sat down with the diocesan official. Her name is Sister Paula Kelleher from Worcester, Massachusetts. And she's in charge of all women that are becoming nuns. And so she basically gave me the clue that I was being followed 24 hours a day and people were tracking my movements. And when I got home, the name of the individual that she was giving me a hint was actually in my email. So I went to someone in law enforcement. I said, "Who is this?" And they said, "Oh, that's CIA. I said, Why do they have a CIA somebody following me? I am not that interesting. I don't do anything." So this is where I realized in 2007, 2008, I went on to the radio show with Greg Szymanski for the first time. And people like Leo Zagami would call me up and ask me to get involved in their projects and things like that because of my background in ecclesiastical Latin. And that's when the picture started coming together. I had access to people with clearances now because Leo's security team, many of them were in the Department of Defense and so forth. So I had the privilege of being connected. And I would have many, many conversations. And that's where this topic about the Jesuits came up. And so now I'm concerned. It's 2008. And I'm like, okay, some people are following me. They're tracking my every move. I think I need to stop what I'm doing. Don't do any more radio shows. Don't stir the pot. And let's see if I can just leave here and go mind my business somewhere else. And that's what I did. I moved to Texas. And I thought I was minding my business quite well. I started to study private law and got involved, and it was very successful. I ended up helping some people very powerfully through different, let's just say, unconventional means. And that's when in 2012, I believe it was March or April, bad with chronology, but it's all in my books. Just so you have a sense of what we're dealing with in terms of data, this entire case is... This is only part of it, okay? This is only part of it. This book right here is only part of my case, okay? This whole entire file. And so there's a lot going on here. So I'm in Texas, Just want to make sure you're still here.
Yep, okay. I'm here.
Excellent.
Just listening. Like, well, you know, most guests, you got to keep them going, but you just, you know, you just keep moving right along. So we're just flowing right through it. Great.
Excellent. Perfect. So basically, now I've got the FBI who want to sit down and talk with me. And I'm like, I want to be hospitable. I want to be open-minded and see if I can be of help to them. The hilarious part is I was expecting to receive a phone call from someone from the Thomas Kincaid Gallery because I ordered a painting for a friend of mine. And FedEx, I thought they were the ones calling me, and I was in the ladies' room. Well, I go to pick up the phone, and it's not FedEx, it's the FBI. And I'm like thinking to myself, oh no, I always have recorders on me 90%, 99.999% of the time I have a recorder on me because I've always had to collect information and data. And so I go to reach down to get my briefcase to get the recorder, and I proceed to ask the agent, what is this in regards to? And they say they want to know more about a friend of mine or something. And I was like, okay. I said, okay, I'm more than happy to assist. And I said, is Kiri Berner under any form of investigation by the FBI? Yes or no? No, which I already knew that I was. Not for a bad thing, not for a crime, but I found that out later. But it's unnerving, so especially when you're on the toilet and you're trying to reach for your recorder and the toilet flushes. And I'm like, this isn't good. This is really bad. And I started laughing, and I said, well, I guess you know where my office is. And they were trying not to laugh. I could tell he was trying to be very professional on the phone. And so I basically invited him to go to the Staybridge Suites that day. I think it was at 2:00. And I said, I'll see you at 2:00. We sit down. And here's the question they asked me, which really was unnerving. I mean, they were very cordial. They didn't flash their badges. They were very kind people. But after an hour of discussion, toward the end of it, they were asking, do you believe the Pope owns us all through the collateralization of our birth certificates? And I had two witnesses. I had a friend with me there. I'm like, I am not fixing to answer any of that. Because first of all, that's above his pay grade. Second of all, I'm not getting into it. I don't want them to know what I know. So I basically said, you know, something like, well, whatever's on Facebook, I'm not responsible for what's out there on the internet, except for what I post and what I do. And so I changed the subject. It's called Confess and Avoid. And later I found out they wanted to hire me as a CHS or a CI. And allegedly, because I know, they said in the file that I knew a lot and that I had an alphanumeric code and that only Congress could get into the file or something. So I was like, all right, this is really weird. So things like that were happening to me. And I had contacts all over the world, and they were reporting to me about what was going on. I mean, I literally walked into some guy's place, and he was a high-level Freemason. And my friend was with me, another one, and he walked up to his desk and said, I have your the name in the dossier of the FBI agent who sat with you. I said, how do you have that? I never told you who talked to me. And he said, we're watching your back. So basically, I'm like, why are people watching my back? Why are people following me? What is it about my life that I know that I don't know? So now here's where things start taking a very
interesting. I know that feeling.
It doesn't make sense. It's like you think you're living your life, right? And you think you're being harmless, and it doesn't make any sense.
Well,
it just,
anybody who speaks truth is not harmless.
I guess so. I guess I learned the hard way on that one.
I think, doesn't the Bible, you know, I mean, you know, God cannot lie. Jesus is the way, the truth, the life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, like 219 times.
And the truth will set you free. Sure does.
Well,
free from a lot of things.
Yeah, well, and so anybody who speaks the truth, they're always going to try to suppress that information because Satan is the father of all lies. So
what was it about my story that caused them a problem? So here's the deal. I go in for a surgery in 2011 of July. Okay, in July. And I had the heebie-jeebies about it. So I had some people with clearance come up and just make sure everything's okay, make sure someone wasn't going to do something to me under surgery. So I came out of the surgery and I thought everything was fine, but I started having these, you know, the itchy, you know, episodes, And I blamed the hospital. I said, you guys have bed bugs or something. Give me some cream. And it was nothing of the sort. So time moved on 5 weeks later, and I'm still scratching like nothing. And those creams weren't working. And I'm like, I just took pictures, and I would keep a journal because I didn't know what it was. And the only thing I could do is just take down data. So a year back in 2012 of November, I started feeling something's really wrong.
Well, before we go there, I wanted to get into some of your case material first. Do you mind?
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you know, so we've already gone into hermetism.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about more about your case and what happened to you and this Reverend Joseph Chukong.
Okay.
I just kind of want to flush out as much of this case as we can, because what I'd like to really get toward is what is clearly a rampant problem within the Catholic Church. And, you know, I mean, most people think Catholic priest is synonymous with or a pedophile, right? Yeah. So, you know, and you automatically know that. So, anyway, I just want to flesh out more of the specifics of your case if we can, because I did read over, you know, quite a bit of the notes on your website and things like that. And I think that's kind of an interesting story I want to get into first. And then we can go into some of the other investigatory research that you did about nanotech, et cetera, toward the end.
Excellent. Okay, good. All right. Well, basically, in my naivete, I really thought that if I brought my matter forward, that the priest or the church would want to do, quote unquote, the right thing, especially if I was not in a threatening way asking them to do the right thing. So one of the interesting matters that was unfolding in regards to the case was that when this thing happened to me, when the priest grabbed my chest, I waited for another monk to go on duty, a friend of mine. His name was Brother Philippe Macron was the first one I spoke with, and then Brother Patrick the following day. And I was, keep in mind, I was sleeping. I was at the monastery on retreat for the whole week. So I didn't want to make a scene. I didn't want anything to change. I just wanted to talk to my best friends. So I did. And the monk stayed up with me till 3 a.m. We talked almost the entire evening. And he basically said, to keep this confidential, he said, if you were a monk at our monastery, you would be the abbot. And I said, that's nonsense, Philippe. I said, come on, you know, why would you say that? And he's like, no, you don't understand. You're coming here from a true heart, and you want to pray, and you want to give your heart to God, but there's people here. They're not being like monks. They have another agenda. And I said, that's hogwash. Because I just couldn't believe him. I was like, why are you saying that? And he said, I overheard monks talking about a way to try to set you up and have you leave. I said, why would they go to such a degree to just have me leave like that, to make up something and have a priest do this? He said, because you know too much. I said, brother, I don't know anything. And see, now at the time, I was very non-judgmental. So if I heard something, I would just put it in a category and say, oh, that priest is struggling with a certain kind of a sin, or that monk was struggling with a sin or something. And I would just say, oh, well, we just need to pray for you and let's work together on this. Like, these people would jump over the wall and ask me to be their spiritual director. I'm in my early 20s, okay? And these guys are older. You know, they've been at the monastery for over 30, 35 years. And literally, the tears were coming down. Like, this monk asked me, I got to be careful because I don't want the name to come out. But basically, he's like, I want you to be my spiritual director. I'm like, are you out of your mind? I said, I'm trying to get canonical status with the bishop. And in order for me to do that, I have to have a spiritual director from here. So I said, I'm not saying no, but if you ask your abbot and he gives permission, then I will say yes, only if he gives permission. So he goes back, he asks the abbot. The abbot says, well, you got a good choice. It was the priory at the time, Father Isaac. And he said, Father Isaac said, good choice with picking Sister Bernor. That's a good choice, but you shouldn't be unfair to her. You don't want to put the burdens of the abbey on her shoulders. Well, I didn't know the level of what I was dealing with. This man was telling me he was seriously addicted to porn. And all I could ask him was, do you know that that's a sin? And he would say, well, yes. And I was like, well, all right, so you know it's a sin, so don't do it. I thought, you know, it's as simple as that, you know? But I'm not dealing with that. There's something bigger going on. And then other monks would come up to me and tell me that monks from within the monastery would, you know, would sexually harass them. And that's when I finally said, because I was looking at all of this in the paradigm of, oh, this is a sin. This is how sin is dealt with. I didn't have a bigger understanding of how to deal with these things. So I said, come live at my house. I'll get an extra job and I'll take care of you. You don't need to live here if people are attacking you. So when all of this stuff happened, as far as the case itself, I didn't want to go to court. I tried to resolve this in-house. When I had dialogues with the monk that was in charge of the internal investigation, the monk that was in charge, Father Isaac, he completely turned the whole thing against me. And he was taking down data. He didn't report anything to the police. They hired a private investigator on me. So when I went into the courtroom, they didn't even tell me that. And it's supposed to be in the file. You know, you can't just do that. You have to have some record that you've hired somebody and for a good cause. So when I brought this forward, and I only asked for the priest to not work with women, the priest wrote a letter and said, in front of my friend, Grace Haggerty, I promise to ask the abbot Dom Damien Carr to have him not work with any women inside or outside of the monastery. And so he wrote the promise to me and I wrote to him. I said, I promise I won't bring this allegation forward in a court matter. We will stop the court if we can just have you agree to that. And so in the trial, the monk priest said, basically, I only agreed to ask my superior. I didn't agree not to work with women. You see how that tricky that gets? Now, he was a graduate of Fordham University. That's a Jesuit college, okay? So this is a total Jesuit way of dealing with things. And again, all these details you can find in my book, but I'm going to see if I could actually find the letter where he handwrites out the agreement. But it has the police reports. This is the very file they were trying to suppress. This is the police report that they wanted the court case to go forward. And when, in fact, we have another victim of St. Joseph's Abbey named on the first page, 5/13/2002, this is the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Department of State Police. Detective Ryan, I believe, is the one who wrote this report. He says, I made contact with Singleton via telephone. She said approximately 10 or 12 years ago, Chu Kong, the same priest, grabbed her breast and squeezed it. She said that it was definitely an intentional act. Singleton reported that around the time of the incident, she had conversation with Chu Kong about it. She said that he initially tried to explain it away, but subsequently, and it goes on and on and on. All of this to say, this victim survivor asked the Abbey to not move forward with the court case and said, listen, I will tell you my story if you don't move forward with this. And so, no, what did they do? They kept it all and they continued to use the court case to destroy my credibility. So I came out in the court of public opinion and basically just exposed one thing after the other with the Abbey and their dirty dealings. Here's the letter that Father Joseph Chu Kong wrote to me, promising me he'll ask his superiors to no longer work with women inside or outside of the monastery. And you know, I believe in his heart that this priest really did want to do the right thing, but his superiors were the ones that were using this to try to destroy my credibility. So that's an interesting. So the, all that information you're going to see relating to the case is all. This book goes up to the year 2008. So I've got to write a book from now, or edit it more exactly, from this point from 2008 to the present, because it gets more and more interesting. So did that fill in any gaps, or do you need anything else to kind of...
Yeah, well, that's that's definitely where I wanted to go. So let's see. And on your website, you say, I was abused by a monastic priest around the context of the sacrament and confession. Mm-hmm. Although there was an incident, an indecent assault and battery that took place, my experience of how the abuse devastated me was when I brought the allegations forward to the ecclesiastical authorities. So that's what you're discussing here. And then, let's see. What I thought was a spiritual gang rape, what I went through was a spiritual gang rape. And, you know, this is the pattern that I see that they do with anyone who is trying to expose anything. They go through this whole thing. In fact, perpetrators, you know, it's like this Cartman triangle. You have victim, perpetrator, and I forget the other one now. I'd have to pull it up. But so what they'll do is they'll vacillate. Let me pull that up here so that I can show people Cartman drama triangle, and they'll vacillate between the victim and the rescuer, pretending that you are in need of rescue and that they are the victim of your assaults, not them being the persecutor. And I see this constantly with the trolls and with all of this stuff, you know. So here's what I'll just show that on screen there. That's what the triangle looks like. And so they never want to be in the perpetrator position. They always want to play either the victim or the rescuer. Oh, Carrie, oh, Jan, you've lost your marbles. You know, we have to bring you back to the fold. We have to get you back in line. How could you say such terrible things against us? And then, you know, so what they have to do at all costs is avoid exposing themselves as the perpetrator. And so, you know, this is what I see constantly against my work with the trolls out there who do this stuff, you know, relentlessly to me. And, you know, in the things that I've uncovered over the years. And I've seen it on all sorts of levels, through low level, like high school dropout trolls, to Harvard professors, literally, to former people under the employ of the White House, and, you know, people that were apparently Jesuit trained, etc. I've seen all levels of this stuff, so I get what you're talking about. And then you say I characterize it as an institutional abuse by those who promised to be spiritual guardians to me. The betrayal shook the very foundations of my faith and all that I knew of God and the church. And, you know, here's the thing with so many Catholics, as they go through and they have these bad experiences, and then all of Christendom gets blamed for the actions of the Christian church. And that's really the most terrible thing of all, you know, and I see that so much. And then it says the betrayal, let me see. Would be called into question, although my faith in the institution has diminished over time. It has become more solid in God himself. And thanks for those of you who are donating through the website. Obviously, my primary channel is shut down, and I can no longer have super chats because I went on InfoWars last month and told the truth. So, again, you know, more punishment for telling the truth. This is the retribution they... And then, meanwhile, these people are allowed to have the same person that I interviewed with, Alex Jones, on their show and not get banned. But I got banned for my live feed was shut down for 3 months for telling kids not to do drugs.
Wow.
And, you know, I'd like to talk to you off the air as well when we have time one of these days. But so going on here, you say... Let me see. I thought that my having served the church for over a decade and experiencing expressing to the church authorities that I did not wish to bring my allegations into the legal forum, while reiterating that I was not interested in a monetary settlement, that they would do the right thing. Soon I became aware that they were not operating on a spiritually wholesome level, but plainly a demonic one. You know, and that's just it. You know, it's like the secret combinations and the backroom, backhanded stuff. I mean, you know, when you understand Christ, it's all about living in truth and doing the utmost to be in truth all the time and follow what is true. Then when you do that to the best that you can, you know, of course we all fail, but you know, you actually begin to see those who are trying to undermine. You know, it goes back to the Bible, you know, those on the right hand of God versus those on the left hand of God. And when you're on the right hand of God, it shows you those who are on the left hand, which is, of course, Satanism. And suddenly, you know, people that you thought were friends, you know, you can see them and you can see their actions and how they do these things. So, you know, what I see is you're experiencing this all around you within the church. So when did you leave the Catholic Church?
In 2008.
And do you mind if I ask what denomination you are now, or...
Oh, no, not a problem at all. It took me 3 years to study. I didn't know who Jesus was after all this. After 7 years, I was like, who is God? You know, and also dealing with that person, like I mentioned, Leo Zagami, and being in his group of people, they were presenting Gnosticism. They were presenting me with some really strange things. So I went in depth into study, into Freemasonry, Gnosticism, the early church, and I arrived at Orthodoxy.
Did you?
And having read the book, The Papacy, by Abbe Goutte, I might have said his name wrong, Father Vladimir, who in the late 1800s had access to the Vatican archive, he found out that the whole papacy was a complete fabrication, and that the original church had no understanding of that whatsoever, the way it's understood now in Romanism. And so after Correct. I finished reading that book, and then I had a Hebrew scholar, Greek, someone who could read Greek, and I translate Latin, and I pulled up this document because I was like involved in the studies of Franco Collins and the Almanac of Evil, and then
this might throw you for a loop. From my own research, the Vatican was not built in Rome. The Italian Rome didn't exist until the late 13, early 1400s.
Very interesting.
And the real Rome was Tartary, which was the old world order. And now, of course, we see them replacing it with the new world order. But this explains why the Orthodox Church, which is Russia, Serbia, Greek Orthodox, et cetera. And I've been to the monasteries in Matoya, Greece. But the reason why that is the original is because that was all at one point Tartary, and there's been a significant effort to cover that up. So, you know, it's like, you know, basically the Jesuits, again, Joseph Scaliger and Denis Batavius, who they started it under the Jesuits, and then it looks like at the Council of Trent they spent 17 years rewriting the history. And this is what the Crusades were really about. They weren't about, the Inquisitions weren't about witchcraft. It was about eliminating the books that discussed Tartary and this stuff and presenting a new history to the public. And then they went out and they acquired and burned all of the old historical information to cover up the history of this massive Tartar empire. And then they rewrote that, and the Jesuits went around and seeded false religions throughout the area. So we see the dissemination of these religions. Like Tibetan Buddhism, for instance, came about in the late 1400s, and we're told it's supposed to be ancient or whatever, but it's really not. And it's another one of these sexual predator religions, from what I've found in my own research. And I've, you know, been looking into, like, the 14th Dalai Lama. He's tied every way from Sunday to nefarious groups, and he was on the CIA payroll for up through the 70s, and probably still is, But there's numerous newspaper articles discussing the Dalai Lama, and let me see if I can find that.
Hold on. And how do you spell Tartary? T-A-R-T-A-R-Y?
T-A-R-T-A-R-Y, correct, or T-A-R-I-E. And it's a, you know, and since we started looking in on it, there's been a lot of groups coming out exposing more about it, but I'm just showing on the screen here the 14th Dalai Lama, and in the notes here on the side, people can find newspaper articles and et cetera that he was on the CIA's payroll for many years, and he's involved in, you know, he's a Marxist but claims that he's against Chinese Marxism. He's heavily influenced by the Club of Budapest, and let's see, he was part of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. I have him marked as one of the top evil villains in my database, but you know, tied to a lot of nefarious people, the Naropa Institute. I have him tied to pedophilia in general, but anyway, let me get that out of the way.
No, that's interesting, because that's the Cistercians are actually had him. I think it was at trying to think of the name of the monastery. I think he was a guest speaker at Gethsemane, I think it was, in Kentucky.
I'm not sure.
And there's an actual article with the Dalai Lama going there and talking about, this was under the time of Thomas Merton, when he would go around and do his talks on centering prayer and all that. So that's an interesting tie that we have with the very same spiritual tradition that the monastery where I was sexually abused at is the same monastic tradition where they would actually have these ecumenical gatherings. And to me, that's all a front. The ecumenical gatherings are used for basically the public face to be able to think that this is interfaith faith dialogue when it's really about the, you know, the planning for the subjugation of that country, which they're targeting.
Well, you know, in my 20s, I was married to a Serbian woman, and every summer, and people like to spin wild conspiracies out of this that, you know, but every summer I would go and I would live in Serbia, and this was during the war, so a lot of times we would have to fly into Budapest and take a car all the way into Belgrade, this kind of stuff. But when I lived there, I spent a lot of time mostly just reading, because it was pretty boring, you know, we didn't really have a lot of money to go places and do stuff, so we just sat around the house. Every year I would literally take a suitcase of books with me to read. And I would hear these stories of Constantinople was originally called Tsargrad or Tsarigrad, which meant the king's city, and that it was the capital of the kingdom of Serbia, which was the largest country in the world at the time. And when I heard this, I thought it was so absurd. And now in hindsight, I know that they were talking about Tartary. And the Tartar Empire not only stretched from Constantinople and up, you know, and, you know, it appears that the original Rome, excuse me, was Constantinople, Alexandria, and Moscow. And it appears what happened, and it's really hard to flush out because so much of the history beyond 400 years has been distorted and twisted, but it appears that the black plagues that swept Europe and wiped out upwards of 70 million Europeans were done intentionally to destroy this Tartar Empire and the original Rome so that they could impose this fake Vatican, you know, that didn't come about until, you know, in Italy, like I said, until the late 13, early 1400s. So, and there was a division. There's one researcher in Russia who says that two brothers diverged and one created the Catholic Church or whatever, and I don't remember the exact details of it. I'll have to go back through his work and study up on that. But I find that, you know, that the Catholic Church is, in fact, a false or an inverted church, you know. And it's and the first thing that should tell you this, I think, what is it? Timothy, the book of Timothy, tells you that the priests are supposed to be true fathers so that they're invested in the community through their children. And mm-hmm. So the first cue is that, wait a second, none of the priests in the Catholic Church have children, so they're not actually invested. So then it becomes a refuge for predatory people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so rather than being invested in the community, they're preying on the community. And then when you start to understand this, you know, I came down to a few churches when I was looking at them, but it became apparent to me that the Catholic Church wasn't one of them. And it became apparent that the Orthodox Church was. And, you know, so just right away, though, the tip off of Catholic priests not having any children is a big red flag. And then you see scandal after scandal because of that. And then, of course, they're not married, you know, whereas in the Orthodox Church, they're allowed to be married, they're allowed to be parents, et cetera. And so, you know, so clearly, you know, the Bible itself lays this out. And then you have the issue of, you know, well, you have the Orthodox Bible, and then they have, like, just in the Old Testament, what is there? I think 12 chapters removed. Then you have, you know, Daniel is not the last chapter of the Old Testament. It's pushed back 12. So you have all these 12 things going on with them pushing it back 12 chapters, removing 12 chapters compared to the Protestant Bible like the KJV, and all this weird stuff going on. So I started picking up on that. But then you start reading, like, Susanna and the Dragon and this sort of stuff, and it's like, wait, oh, I understand why they took that out. But anyway, I'm kind of digressing here a little bit. I wanted to get into some of these. One of the most interesting things I found on your website that you were discussing was the Crimen Solis.
You wanna...
Thank you. Thanks for the save.
The Crime of Solicitation. So that's a document that Father Doyle, Thomas Doyle, he was a canon lawyer who is the connected into the Vatican ambassadorship from America to the Vatican. And he actually came across a lot of the sexual abuse that was going on. And he said, we're running into a problem, and this could be a huge epidemic if we don't fix it. So he would present this to subsequent popes. And of course, prior to the 2000 and the Boston cases breaking loose in 2002. So he was a canon lawyer. He came across this document, Crime of Solicitation, which was, I think, signed in 1963, stamped by a Cardinal Ottaviani. And from what I understand, I believe he was a high-ranking Freemason. And in therein in the document, it's Latin, but if you have it translated, there's a part of it that talks about where priests are trained in the seminary. These are the norms that priests receive when they were learning at the time in the 1960s and 70s, what to do if a child would bring forward a matter regarding a priest in confession, having been abused by a priest or something. And so the priests were instructed to basically cause the kid, you know, to be silenced. And threaten the kid. If you continue to bring this matter forward, we're gonna put your family under what do they call that? Interdict, or it's just a canonical term for basically silencing them or punishing them, even to the point of excommunication. So this document obviously is what I used in order to procure my resignation when I met with the official from the Diocese of Worcester. And I asked Sister Paula, I said, have you ever read this document? And her face dropped. And I just said, I can't be a part of this church anymore. I can't do it because in good conscience, you know, this is completely opposite of the gospel of Christ. This has nothing to do with what Christ is like. No, let the little children come to me. This is not the way Christ would ever handle a situation like this. And she said, this is what she said. She said, the church is a system that's set up to fail us. I said, well, why are you still a part of it? She said, I'm 80 something years old. I just had open heart surgery or whatever it was. And there's nothing much I can do. And I said, well, I can't stay here. I've got to get out. She's like, well, can we still be friends? I said, well, of course. Of course we could still be friends. But it's interesting that meeting was generated after I went on the Greg Szymanski's Arctic Beacon show, and I exposed name by name of the Freemasons, who they were, the bishop, former bishop, Bishop McManus, we used to call him McAnus. And we would basically say,
aren't you supposed to be a nun?
I'm supposed to be, but in this moment, I'm enjoying myself. So at this point, I exposed literally, you know, the associations with him and the Freemasons. And then Mary T. Jean got onto the program, and she actually started talking about her situation where a federal judge allowed her a special injunction so that all state police in Massachusetts were barred from going near her, like a restraining order, within X amount of feet, because, and John J. Conte, who was the district attorney at the time, you can find this on YouTube, Massachusetts State Police, Mary T. Jean versus Massachusetts State Police. And when I went to that federal court and saw that judge sign the order, basically giving her protected status, essentially in her own way, from the state police, then I realized there was something much more going on. Mary T. Jean was the one who headed the WisterVoice.com, and she was the one supporting the victims of clergy sexual abuse in the Diocese of Worcester. So this is how I knew that Vatican was playing a big part in Massachusetts state politics. And then later, when I kept connected through to, you know, Greg Szymanski, Christopher Strunk, other, you know, whistleblowers, even in the Catholic Church, you know, whistleblowers, that's when I realized this isn't just Massachusetts. There's a bigger plan that they have in mind. So bottom line is, you're absolutely right. They do not want to be esteemed as the perpetrators. They want to be seen as the victims. And that's one of their best tactics that they use. And I mean, who would ever
total inversion every time. And I see it so much. I see it just constantly because, you know, as I told you before, when I first reach out to you, I'm one of the leading experts on MKUltra out there. And the whole 60s psychedelic counterculture was created lock, stock, and barrel by the CIA. And I've found the documents and the people behind it, and I exposed all of that. And I've been attacked relentlessly for the last 8-9 years because of it. People that I thought were friends, you know, all kinds of stuff. And they get in and they infiltrate you, pretend like they're your friend. And then when you figure out that they're dirty, they flip it on you and pretend like you're the one out there attacking everybody. And you're the one who's, you know, causing all of this stuff. But they can't ever let the public know who's under their mind control, that they are actually the perpetrators of it. So, you know, they constantly use inversion, invert, and all manner of fallacies as well. But, you know, the key thing that they do, especially these Satanists, which is really telling, you know, they'll sit there and deny that they're a Satanist while they exactly invert the truth. Well, that's what Satan does. So let's see. Let's get into, you have the Vatican has a no child protection policy.
Ah, yes, the Dallas norms back in 2002 or what, but these the National Bishops Council, or Council for Bishops, or whatever it is, the NCCB, they came together and they were going to come up with a program in order to protect children. And when you read the program closely, Mary Jean and I flipped out. We couldn't believe it. Because it's like, what is it? Three strikes and you're out. So you would have to be proven to actually have assaulted a child three times before you get, you know, pushed to the next place or punished or canonically sanctioned or whatever. And that document, I don't have readily in front of me, but when we saw that document, when it came out, it was one of the most disturbing things because it's a three time strikeout policy. When in fact it should be obviously a one time. You mess up once and this is a done deal. Now it's interesting with the canon lawyer, Doyle, the priest, Father Doyle, he was finding that it's interesting that our fathers and our nation were very wise people. You know, when Samuel Morse said, we do not need to have Vatican diplomatic relations, because if we do that, that's the beginning of our downfall. Well, that's the thing. When this priest, this canon lawyer, would actually do more research, he found out that many of the files were being held in Washington, D.C. under the cover of diplomatic diplomatic pouches, diplomatic documentation in order to evade being investigated. So that's many documents were being held at the Apostolic Nuncio in Washington, D.C. It was a shock. So these are the things we need to watch out for. And as a nation, you got to ask, if one priest is known to serial offend and get about 300 children, okay, that's just one priest. There's a compendium one can purchase. Ever since I've been talking about this book, it went up $500 in value. Randy,
of course, that's another tactic too, is buy them all out so that, yeah, so the public can't get a hold of them, and then make it so normal people can't afford them. That's I've seen that a lot too.
Unbelievable. Isn't so it? It's like $680 now, but it's called The Rite of Sodomy, R-I-T-E of Sodomy, by Randy Engel, E-N-G-E-L. And
is it all pedivores at the top?
It's pretty much.
You realize, like, reading through the Old Testament and what Jesus stood for, that the vampirism was real because the blood is the life, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so then you see all of these blood drinking, blood sacrifice rituals and things going on, and then you go, wait a second, doesn't the Bible warn, I think, at least 19 times not to drink the blood because the blood is the life? And then you have Satanists who are going to go, I know, let's drink the blood, right? You know, they're gonna invert the Bible and do exactly the opposite of what it says, and then, you know, they drink the blood, and this is why they're supposed to be excommunicated from society for doing so, because then they, you know, start to feed on everybody, especially the children, you know, the ambrosia, and this is why Jesus, you know, died for the sins of this, saying, you know, do this in remembrance of me, you know, stop the blood rituals and the blood sacrifices, you know, follow me and follow me in truth in remembrance of that stuff. But that's the old covenant. Don't do that stuff anymore.
Yeah, it's a done deal. Christ already did it all. It doesn't need to be redone. It's done. He's poured out his whole life for us, for eternal life, so we could have the eternal. And so, yeah, that's what shocked me. When other victims would call me of St. Joseph's Abbey's monk, this particular one, Edward John Mullaney, and they would talk to me about how the priest would ask from his victims, menstrual blood. This was years ago. This was way back before this stuff was all over the TV now. But in urine and in fluids and all of this stuff. People like me, when I'm hearing this, it just didn't make any sense. You know what I'm saying? Because people who are not thinking in that way can't understand how someone else could think that way. But obviously, it's a slippery slope, and once you go down that road, it's pretty nasty stuff.
All right, let's bring it back a little bit. That's always so gruesome a topic. All right, so let's see here. You discuss how, okay, the official history is, as we all hear it, is that the Orthodox Church came out of the Catholic Church, when you discuss how the Catholic Church actually came out of the Orthodox Church. Would you talk about that?
Definitely. You know, there was underpinnings in Rome that was already unhealthy. And one of the, it's interesting, it was foretold back in the year, I think it was 690 or 89 or something like that, under Pope Gregory, I think it was the fifth or the sixth. I have the quotation, but basically, he basically says when there was a patriarch in Constantinople who was alleging that he was higher than the other bishops, and there was a primacy. This Pope Gregory actually said, oh no, that's never been the belief of the early church. The early church has always believed that he who says that they are first among equals, the first, you know, the one with a higher level of authority over the other patriarchates, that he will be the predecessor to the Antichrist. And I have the documentation on that. But that's very powerful. And that comes from the Roman patriarch at the time. I say patriarch because that's when they were all still one. Okay. And there's a bunch of documentation that gets into all this stuff. But the Orthodox thing, the thing that made the most sense to me, was the book, The Papacy. When I read that book, and it's right over there. It's on my shelf. I could go get it and put it in the camera if you'd like. You'd like that?
And somebody's asking me which Orthodox study Bible I just said it. The Orthodox study Bible. Huh?
Which is the KJV. We're not one of those. We're not Jesuit turned. All right, you want to go deep into the subject? I don't know. Here we go.
Well, I like the Orthodox study Bible because it has so many of the removed chapters that actually the ones I've read are pretty fulfilling. But they actually, for the New Testament, they do use the KJV. So they just follow the Septuagint for the Old Testament on this one. So somebody was just asking, so I'll just post that one up in there.
Okay. And this is the book, The Papacy, by Abbe Guettet. Now it's Guettee, who later became Father Vladimir. He had access to the Vatican archives and realized that the wool was pulled over his eyes. And so, you know, it's very, very powerful information. When he came across it and they realized what he was doing to research this primacy matter regarding St. Peter being the first Pope of Rome, which isn't true, that's when they barred him from being able to go back into the Vatican archive and said, no, you're done. You're finished with your research. We're not giving you access anymore. So that's a very powerful book. When I finished reading that, that's when I called my bishop, meaning the Metropolitan. We don't call them bishops, we call them Metropolitan. And I said, listen, I'm on my way. You know, there's probably 5 feet of snow, but I'm coming. And he said, well, whenever you get here, I said, I want to be Orthodox. I'm done. I studied for 3 years. This makes the most sense to me, this book right here, on that subject matter.
Interesting. I'll have to talk to you about that more later. Wow, we're already past the hour. So let's see here. I still have quite a few more topics to get into down here. The Roman Church invested with demons. That's a whole other topic. People have to understand what demons are, and I'm not sure if people are ready to understand that. You know, a lot of times when you mention demons, people just start scoffing at the idea. But, you know, demons can manifest in a number of different ways. Let's see here. Monks sexually abused at St. Joseph's Abbey. What's that about?
That's what we covered a little bit earlier, where they would jump over the wall and just tell me they were being attacked against their will, of course.
Okay, now here's something that I wanted to bring up. Every priest in the Roman Catholic Church takes a vow of loyalty to the Pope of Rome, who is a foreign potentate and has a recognized position of authority at the UN. So they're not... You know, so what this is doing is they're taking their vow of loyalty to the Pope in Rome and not to the United States.
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely. That makes a whole lot of sense. So people should be aware of that. And we see this a lot with Zionists too, with their, you know, with their double citizenship for Israel and the United States, et cetera. So which one are you loyal to?
Exactly.
Let's see. We discussed the origins of the Catholic Church. Ah, here we go. Who was J. Peter Grace, and how is he involved in the Sovereign Military Order of Malta?
Okay. Now, this is where the big puzzle pieces all start to come together. Why I was specifically being followed, and there was a bigger thing that I didn't know about. Okay. When I was going through what I went through as far as the sexual abuse, I thought, oh, well, it's all out in the courts. What else do they need? Why do they still have to follow me after the court? So there's something more going on. So I ended up talking to Eric Phelps in, I believe it was 2007, and we continued to talk throughout the years. And I read his book, which you probably have. The Vatican Assassins.
I've read some of it, but I need to actually, now I'm going to have to go back down and really go back and really read it. You know, I just sort of skimmed it, and it must have been more than a decade ago when I first came across his work. And, you know, I was looking at so much information and so much evidence of Zionism being in that position that I just looked at his work and was like, you know, he's doing a bait and switch. So now I'm thinking that I fell for the bait and switch. I'm not sure yet. I still have to look at all the evidence, though, you know.
Yeah, there might be, they might be dovetailing together, but I'm going to read parts of that book to give you some insight into where J. Peter Grace fits into this whole dynamic with St. Joseph's Abbey. Okay, this is the book.
Okay, grief. That's Eric John Phelps' book?
Yes, now, for those who
I wonder if he'll send me a copy if I tell him, hey, after I read that 1,500 pages, I'll have you on this show. How many pages is it? Is that about 1,500?
He'll probably send you this just to be nice to you so you don't have to deal with it.
I don't know. Reading on a screen would probably be worse for me than an actual hard copy.
I see what you're saying on that. So basically, yeah, this book here is, 1,800 pages.
Oh, yeah. Good grief.
Yeah, this is hardcore. But I like it because it has a lot of pictures. I like the pictures he's put together. But basically, on the J. Peter Grace issue, here's what he has on page 1092, J. Peter Grace and Henry R. Luce. Luce.
Oh, from the Time Life magazine, Henry Luce. I've done a lot of investigation into him.
Interesting. Did you know he donated for Mepkin Abbey, property to Mepkin Abbey?
No, I didn't.
Okay, so I'm finding it interesting that J. Peter Grace.
Well, he was Skull and Bones, so that would make sense, right?
In retrospect, of course, but not in the moment, because when I was a nun, I thought, I had no idea that.
Yeah, you didn't want to know about all this bad stuff going on.
I had no idea. I thought it was just the New World Order. I had no idea that we were the center of the New World Order. I had no idea. It's shocking.
Yeah, you know, and I've been seeing a lot of things about that, too, coming up recently about, in fact, maybe one of my notes was off of your page here, and I may have missed it, but let's see.
So, J. Peter Grace.
They took their eyes off of Christ and 1054 and embrace the Antichrist as the vicar of Christ.
Exactly. Excellent. I'm glad you found that. And I apologize because normally I would be more prepared, but I didn't know we were going to go down these rabbit trails.
Oh, sorry. I have lots of rabbit holes in my yard.
Good. It's fun that way. So J. Peter Grace, he's commemorated on the altar at St. Joseph's Abbey. He is one of the main founders of the monastery, and he's donated the funds to build the abbey back in the 1950s. So what I have here is a picture of the altar where his name is inscribed, and he is commemorated. And this is to the glory of God Most High, in honor of the Blessed Virgin Mother of God, Mary, the founder of our order of sweet memory, founder of our Abbey, Joseph Peter Grace, and his wife, Mary Margaret. So that's the altar where his name is inscribed. So when I went to the St. Joseph's Abbey, I actually found there was somebody that was walking with me and pointed to his grave and said, oh, this man named J. Peter Grace is buried up at St. Joseph's Abbey, and he's in his own little area. He's not buried with everybody else. So when Eric Phelps was talking to me about this J. Peter Grace, I flipped out. I couldn't believe it. I was like, nah, that's not the same guy. And he's like, oh, sister, it is. So here's what he has to say. CFR Kingpin, J. Peter Grace Jr., an international shipping tycoon and industrialist, became the head of the American branch of Archbishop Francis Cardinal Spellman's Knights of Malta, while Skull and Bones and CFR member Henry R. Lucifer Luce, leave it to Eric Phelps, he's going to just say it, controlled the American press from Rockefeller Center in New York across the street.
I got something to tell you.
Go ahead.
Henry Luce is who helped Gordon Wasson and Aldous Huxley and the CIA, along with Alan Dulles, kick off the psychedelic revolution.
Oh, my goodness.
Ding, ding, lights just went on.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's my area, and I've been working on exposing. So you're like one step away from the work that I've been working on for 8-10 years exposing.
And I had no intentions of exposing anything. All I wanted to do is pray and love God and pray 10 hours a day and sing chant. All this stuff ended up happening later. So how all this stuff ties together is, well, this is the deal. I'm going to get you one of these, because you really do need to see this. And I'll
all
take
right.
pictures.
Ask him, or, you know, if he'll mail me a hard copy too. If not, I'll take the CD. But okay. So I've got a couple statements here. Let me see. Gonnell had a statement in here. Let me see if I can find it. He says, I have a family that are Catholics. It's strange that they can't see how it goes against the Bible in so many ways. I'm grateful I was never baptized in that church. And then somebody else has a question for you, and this is from Louisa. She says, before this is over, Jan, could you ask Carrie her opinion of Tony Pantelleresco's work?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think he's done tremendous work. He basically is like a pioneer. He's been doing the nanotechnology exposure for the longest time, and he's helping everybody on a more broad range of things. Nanotechnology, you know, coming down through geoengineering and foods and all this other stuff. The only reason I knew about nanotech was because of what happened to me when I was
actually... Yeah, we haven't even gotten to that yet. I was pretty skeptical at first when I came across on your website, and then as I read through more and more, and I downloaded some of those documents and read them, it's like, okay, she actually did her research, and she's got, you know, her evidence together, et cetera. And so, you know, I'm not ready to go there quite yet, though. So if
okay,
we can...
take your time. all this to say is Tony's work is excellent, and yet for those who have been specifically targeted by military-grade nanotechnology, that's kind of more of my expertise.
Yeah, I know Louisa personally, and she's been targeted as well. You know, there's, you know, I'm starting to understand what a targeted individual is. You know, when you become one, and you go, oh, that's what it is.
It's not fun. It starts with the shadow banning and stuff like that.
Well, years of trolls and years of inverting everything you say. You know, it's like one of the latest lies about me is they're trying to scrounge up any history from when I lived in Serbia in my early 20s with my first wife during the summertime. And so what they do is they try to spin it that I was there as an agent or this and that. But so we had founded this organization, like the Croatians, they had a lobbying group. The Bosnians had a lobbying group. The Serbs had nothing. And so we used to go out and protest, you know, against the bombing of Serbs, which, of course, were Orthodox Christians. And so, you know, some of us in the group were like, hey, why don't we found an organization to give us like a legal, you know, platform? So we founded this group called the American Serbian Association for Peace. And then, you know, within a couple of months after we founded it, the war was over. But, you know, what we ended up doing was having a couple of barbecues and a couple of meetings. And one of the guys, Dragan, managed to get himself on CNN during one of the bombings and was talking against the war, and that's all we got accomplished. And then everybody went home, and then the Croats and everybody else still has their lobbying organizations, and the Serbian American Association for Peace, ASAP, was shut down in like 2005, and nothing was ever done with it, you know. But you know, so all of this stuff is always a constant inversion tactic that they're using, always inverting every detail of your life when they target you. And so, you know, this is how you recognize, you know, what's going on. And, you know, the public, you know, when they don't know the details, it's easy just to believe these lies without understanding the background story behind everything and, you know, how it really works. They'll see, you know, maybe a page or two or a couple of pages of things, and it's easy to draw false assumptions, especially when they're intentionally being misled
exactly
that direction. You know, and you have to follow Christ. You know, you have to put truth first. You know, how many times does the Bible say that, folks? It's like, you know, it beats it in, like the New Testament beats it in over and over and over. Get it yet? 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 So, let's see. The failure on the part of the Jesuits to register under state civil rights law. What is that about? Oh, and these are the five causes of action. Mm-hmm. So would you talk about those and one about the Jesuits failing to register as a state civil rights, under state civil rights law?
Well, that's the thing. The Logan Act is kind of like esteemed as a, it's kind of like an old law. But I think there should be a resurgence for it. And I think you're alluding to Christopher Strunk's, to his court case, to his case against the Jesuits. I think this was in Kings County, if I'm correct. And so basically, Christopher goes courageously against the Jesuits and brings this matter forward and says, listen, we have laws on the books. And because you are, as you've established earlier, Jan, is that these guys, when they come here to our country, their first allegiance is to the papacy. And the papacy's, the Pope is not just some guy that prays. He literally is a king. He's a king of Rome.
No, he's not a king. He's the emperor of Rome. And all they did was they, I don't know if you're aware that the Dark Ages were faked. That's a whole other thing that they put there to cover up the creation of the Vatican and all of that in the 1400s. And they, you know, they wanted everybody to think that Europeans were just dumb morons for 1,000 years and couldn't figure out all this old architecture that was just sitting there and just boop, boop. All of a sudden, one day they woke up again. But the joke is in the title, Dark Age. It's like black hole, dark age, you know. And since you were, you know, since you're no longer a nun now, we can just go for a little bit raunchy. The black hole and the Big Bang, it's a raunchy joke, you know.
I get it. I did the McNeilis on you, so I was deserving of that. So here's the deal. This is the complaint that I think you guys were alluding to. And this is the United States District Court, District of Columbia. And this is the verified complaint with the petition, Christopher Earl Strunk. And it basically goes into, you know, Christopher complaining that the Jesuits should be registering under the Logan Act. The Logan Act is still on the books and it should be enforced. So bottom line is the reason I say king instead of emperor is because that's the title that's still engraved on the chair in Rome. It actually says King of Rome, but it's true that he's acting like an emperor, basically. So yeah, I wrote an article about that, and you might have already seen it somewhere. And it basically is Bernor or Sister Bernor counterpoint to the Catholic Church. And I get all into what the Logan Act is, where you can find it in the Code of Federal Regulations, and basically, you know, the essence of it is to protect our nation's interests from these foreign, these other foreign interests, namely that of the Jesuits.
All right, and I'm just going to go back and cover these other five causes of action. So we talked about the failure of the Jesuits to register under state civil rights law. Number two, New York province of the Society of Jesuits, Jesus spiritual practice to eliminate individual faith and hope by actions to molest the innocent and sacrifice heretics to Holocaust. Excuse me. Three, failure to register under the Logan Act, like you just said. Four, violation of the Proxmire Anti-Genocide Act. And five, violation of the international treaties. And then you go on to... or it's on your website, either that or it's citing the other person. Download the exhibits B on page 31 for picture.
Yeah,
anyway.
The picture is of the layout of the concentration camps, and that the layout of the concentration camps are in the configuration of a pentagram.
Oh.
And so that's an important picture. I was pulling that up, but I didn't know how far in depth you wanted to go on that. But Christopher Strunk, he's just tremendous, a tremendous wealth of information, especially about the Jesuits. Eric Phelps also. I'm finding the American intelligence media is also really getting good on that stuff.
The American intelligence media, that's really good. AIM, American intelligence media. Yeah, you know, and it's becoming blatantly obvious at this point. You know, I call the CIA the Central Entertainment Agency because they it's just clear that it's just clear that everybody involved in the mainstream media is on the CIA's payroll. You know, once you've studied this stuff long enough, you see the patterns, and it's like, okay, you know, when I say everyone is dirty, and that's what I see in general for most of alt media as well, you know. And I just put out a show recently about how they co-opt alt media people, and everybody thinks, oh, well, you know, how can Jan or these people say that everybody in alt media or everybody in the MSM are dirty? They would report that. No, they're on the payroll to say, you know, what they're supposed to say. And if you say what they're supposed to say, the large donations, et cetera, will continue to come in, and you don't have to be like me begging for donations from the audience, you know. So everyone, please, you know, support the show. I'm going to put the donation link back up in the chat there. So and it's down there in the comments or in the show notes too. But yeah, please support the show. And then I'm going to let you go into your discussion of the nanotech and what you suspect was done to you. And you know, and this is a little bit off topic, but I've covered how they've been promoting wheat and grains to keep everybody sick too on many levels. And wheat is the number one thing that they're using to keep the population ill right now. And it causes over 40 different diseases. And so you might have one and you go to the doctor and he gives you a pill for this, or you might have several symptoms, but they're all wheat. And the doctor, when you go to the doctor, he doesn't see wheat as the central cause. He sees 40 different diseases. He might see schizophrenia, eczema, psoriasis, IBS, heart attacks, brain fog, all of these kinds of things. There's joint issues and things like that happen, joint pain, arthritis, et cetera. And all of these actually fall under grains and a low-fat diet. So they've inverted everything there again. They tell everybody to eat low-fat rather than high-fat when people live for centuries off of a high-fat diet, which is our performance diet. And they're promoting, the UN is promoting all of this veganism stuff. Well, Plato talks about how veganism is to cull the masses, you know, so this is the agenda behind that. And then they want to promote heavy amounts of wheat consumption. It's the foundation of the pyramid, especially the whole healthy grains, you know, and these are actually what make people the sickest, you know. So you just constantly have to invert everything back the other direction to see how they've spun it all. But let me let you go into your topic there.
No, you're right on point, though, because the wheat is basically, it's of all people who get into that is Tony Pantelaresco. He yells at you. He's like, if you want to be healthy and you're eating wheat, he's like, you're absolutely out of your mind.
Absolutely. Well, so I spent 15 years in and out of the hospital from 94, 95 through 2009. And then my worst was 5 days in the ICU in Peru. And so it was like 41 times to the emergency room and all this kind of stuff over the years. And it was all due to veganism and wheat consumption.
Holy smack, 40-something times.
Yeah.
Wow.
And now I'm off all of the meds. They said I would be dead by 45. They said I would never be able to get off the meds. You know, I walked into the doctor's office one day and I asked him, you know, and he was like, okay, well, we're going to have to switch you off these meds because they're no longer working. We'll give you these other meds. And he almost threw me out of his office because I said, so you think that I have a deficiency in your pills? And he was furious. You know, I'm like, well, I want to get at the root to see what's really causing this, you know. And I just realized there was a bar going across the screen, top of the screen for the whole show. But he was furious and almost threw me out of his office for it, you know, because I just put him on the spot. So you think I'm deficient in these pills?
Well, he could have done something other than that to you too. So these are the issues And I'm glad that you're bringing that up, because I tell a lot of people, you've got to stay away from, you got no corn. You know, what Tony Pantelarsco lines up for a good diet is absolutely right on target. What you're talking about, the high fat, you know, lots of good meat. So go
the ketogenic diet. And I constantly pound this home with people, and people like, I even got into somebody last week, oh, that's just a fad to not eat wheat. And it's like, really? Wow. You know, I wouldn't be alive if I eat even like gluten-free bread for 3 days. I'll be down, you know,
that's it.
And if it goes on for 5 days to a week, I'll be in the hospital. So go ahead.
It's nanotechnology. That's the issue. So what I'll do is I'll make this very broad strokes again, because there's a lot of detail here we could get into. But basically what I experienced and what opened the door for me to have an understanding that nanotechnology existed is when I started to undergo different kinds of symptoms that I couldn't even begin to understand. So in the long and short of it is when I was hearing, you know, having tinnitus, vertigo, dizziness, I couldn't understand. Like I was having symptoms of almost like menopause, but I'm like, wait a minute, I'm too young for that. There's something going on here. I feel like I'm cooking from the inside out. So I called a friend named James Walbert, and I said, hey, and I knew of him because of helping my uncle years ago. Okay. So, and if anyone wants to go more in depth into my story, I have a YouTube channel, Sister Curie Burn, or you could go there. And I get into a lot of the nitty gritty on this stuff, but in the ITNJ, the testimony is really thorough. So, and it's under oath. But basically, I talked to James, and James Walbert said, buy this little device and let's see if perhaps you have a signal coming from your body to the environment. I said, okay, well, let's do that. So I purchased something off of eBay, and he said, you have some sort of foreign material that's emitting a signal from the ear area and around your, you know, abdominal area. And I said, oh, that's nonsense. And he's like, no, this is, you have something going on. I said, the only way I'm going to know, because I bought this from eBay, the machine's probably broken, is I have to go to an expert, a TSCM expert, technical.
Yeah, I read your report on that on your website.
Excellent. So that's for me what helped me to get an objective look at what was taking place. So after 3 hours of being with Melinda Kidder of the Columbia investigation, she no longer does this kind of work, by the way, because it's just not easy. She basically found that there was a 0.02 microtesla or nanotesla reading coming from the same area where James Walbert was saying. And I was like, well, James, wow, I guess James was right. And then she found other signals in the RF spectrum, 2.86 gigahertz switch range, all that nonsense. And I basically said, well, what could this possibly be that's in my body? I said, it certainly doesn't feel good. You know, she said, it's like you're a walking, talking cell phone. So there's something in your body that's able to couple with a transmission so that you can transmit a signal and receive a signal. So I was like, okay, so that makes sense. I said, do you know how this happened? Because I did go in for a surgery, and that's the only thing I could think of where I was knocked out under anesthesia. And so she said, let's see if you can get in touch with this woman named Dr. Hildegard Staniger, who's a toxicologist. So I sat down with the woman, Hildegard Staniger. I didn't know it was a lady at the time until I met with her. So I met with her, and she said, you have definitely a signal coming from your body, and that is a concern, obviously. And she tried to proceed to explain what it was, what the material was that was in my body. And I just said, look, lady, I don't understand this stuff. This is all science. I pulled out my debit card and I said, here, can you fix this? And she said, yes, but it's not going to be fun. It's going to be a very serious protocol, and you're going to have to follow it 4 to 6 months. And I said, fine. I'll be back in 4 to 6 months, and I'm not going to have a signal. I'm going to get rid of this. I wasn't born with this, and I'm not agreeing to it, and I don't know why anyone would bother with me. So she said, it's the Jesuits in the Vatican that are doing this to you. I said, why? I live in Texas. I mind my business. I teach some seminars. I I help people. I don't go on radio anymore. I'm quiet. So why would anyone want to bother with me?
Till tonight.
Exactly. And I've been a troublemaker for forever since, but on and off. So basically she tried to explain to me that the Jesuits, you know, that it's my love for Christ. And I said, wait a minute, there's so many people who love Jesus, you know. She's like, you're not understanding. You know something. I said, I don't know anything. See? And so over time, it all was starting to come together. The relationship of J. Peter Grace. And of course, he's since passed. Okay. He's been dead for a while. His wife just recently passed. And so there's this bigger picture. So let me illustrate what the connections are. In the affidavit that Dr. Hilde wrote, we kindly call her Dr. Hilde, and it'll connect some of the dots. But basically, under the surgical procedure that took place with me, that's when this material was inserted by way of a needle, which the scar was found by the detective. She was able to, private investigator, whatever she is, and she found that there was an incision mark here along my jawline, which I never cut myself there on purpose. I don't shave, so it didn't make sense to have that mark.
Me either.
I can tell. Good. You're looking orthodox these days. So this is July of 2015, and she's writing this in order to appeal to Obama to see if he could put me in some protected status. Obviously, he didn't, okay?
We wouldn't expect him to.
Huh?
We wouldn't expect Obama to.
Oh, no, but I tried. I tried to exhaust all my administrative remedies here, you know? So here she says on page 4 specifically that nanotechnology, that's the part of the conversation she's going at, specifically in Kira Berner's case, it, being nanotech, was used as a bioweapon, a chemical weapon, a weapon of mass destruction with specific parameters used to give her rabbit fever, leukemia, breast cancer, and or colon cancer, as well as the use of nanosilicon, CMOS, MEMS, neurospheroid technology used to violate her privacy, to damage her permanently, and to cause her death. Now, again, this is material, just so you know, that basically it's a weaponized form of nanotechnology. So I'm going to get into more detail on that in a second. Kira Berner was perfectly clear of this technology. So after all those protocols of taking 75 pills a day and doing some really disgusting cleanses that are not fun and they're really gross, it's all formulated here in the story. This is the first time the story's coming out. My story from Targeted to Free, Love is the Answer. This teaches people how I reverse engineered what was happening to me so I could clean my body out from all of this stuff. And the second DVD is also available, hashtag targeted to free, targeted to free, hashtag. And targeted is targeted, the number 2 and free. So I was perfectly clear, okay, perfectly clear of this technology. And since recent tests of porphyrins, other tests pending as of the date of this affidavit, has returned to show a presence of specific nanotechnology composed of hexaconocarboxyls that are specifically used to make porphyrin nanotubes used in hexagonal waveguides, as reported in phase 1. Bottom line, there's stuff in your body, and when it eventually develops over time, the nanotechnology can turn itself into a transmission device and a receiver. Okay, so I'm trying to put this in English so people understand what she's saying. Special request analysis data, June 6, 2015, were reintroduced back into her system. So just so you know, I was free of the technology. There was no longer a signal coming from my body. Then later they attacked me again. And that was altogether 9 physical attempts over a course of 5 years, give or take. She never gave permission for this, that the use of it was for torture, terrorism, and hate crimes reasons against her. Due to Kira Berner's unswerving faith in Christ without adherence to the Catholic faith tenets, recent conversion 2008 to Orthodoxy, a heretical act as defined by the Roman Catholic dogmas and as a mean of retaliation by those who she witnessed against in a criminal trial in 2003 against a priest of the Cistercian order and the Catholic Church. Here it is. The earmarks of Jesuit attack are also seen in that Fordham University pioneered the use of nanotechnology and is one of the leading authorities on the subject. that according to Kerry Berner's testimony, transcripts of trial case number, etc., Commonwealth versus Joseph Chukong, that both priests who testified against her were graduates, affiliates, or professors at Fordham University. See, the Jesuits and the Cistercians have a very tight bond, just like the Jesuits and the Dalai Lama have a tight bond. There's reasons for that, as you know. Affian heard Kerry Berner mentioning her concern that this St. Joseph's Abbey in Spencer, Massachusetts was involved, and that this same abbey had a founder by the name of J. Peter Grace, who is also known as one of the leaders involved in Project Paperclip, an operation that furnished a way to assist German doctors of the Third Reich evade the Nuremberg trials while also assisting with protecting those involved in mind control experiments. German scientists in 1934 developed nanotechnology as microbeads and other related technologies as stated in the book, Nanotechnology, A Gentle Introduction to the Next Big Idea, etc. Copywritten in 2003. Affian believes Kerry Berner to be of sound mind and that her concerns are legitimate. Affian has personally seen the Department of Homeland, we call it the Department of Romeland Security, monitoring meetings outside of the building when Kerry Berner was present with Affian Saturdays, December 7, 2013. So this affidavit basically ties the whole thing together in that St. Joseph's Abbey's founding with this man named J. Peter Grace obviously ties into this German backdrop, okay? And I'm not saying the German nationalists, but I'm saying this Nazi backdrop. And it makes perfect sense that, okay, they're going to use technology to make me look like I'm nuts. Because who else would ever believe me? There's people in the intelligence community that swore up and down, oh no, nanotechnology is not a weapon. That can't exist as a weapon. We wish it could. And I said,
now,
well,
I'm realizing that it's our understanding of what nanotechnology is that's the problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have to question that first and foremost. It's like most of these things, you know, what is your forthright understanding of the situation? What do you think when you hear, you know, it's like geoengineering, you know, and it's like, what was it, 2006, I was standing outside and watching two or three planes flying back and forth spraying, and I ran inside and I grabbed my camera. I'm like, oh my God, it's real. You know? And it was like, wait, that one just turned and flew back and went back and this way. Uh-oh.
Well, if that's happening, I'll run and grab myself some water.
Well, let's see. Yep, it looks like we're live again. So it disconnected for a minute there. Sorry, folks, not sure what happened. But it looks like we're broadcasting again. We're just about done here. But, you know, very interesting discussion. I have a lot more I'd like to, you know, discuss with you on the side. Somebody in the chat asks, Louisa asks, do you have information on in the targeted to free material about healing wounds caused by removed implants?
This actually is... This first DVD gets into how I made the Faraday cave. Let me read you what this is about so you see what's in it. Part one of two, you will learn how I gathered the facts, assessed what was happening to me, and that's specifically with private investigators and so forth, how I shielded myself both physically and spiritually. You'll hear actual testimonies from my team and we'll have my toolbox of remedies that I used to empower myself, to raise my vibration, and to comfort myself in this fact-gathering stage. My approach is faith-based, yet accommodates a universal audience. Now, what you're asking for is in part two. If someone's a target, though, they really need to get the first DVD, because if you clean out all your evidence and then you go back to DVD one out of sequence, then you're not going to have your evidence for court. So you're going to definitely need to follow through with the specifics here. Part two of two, you will learn the methods that I use to cleanse my body of weaponized military-grade nanotech, how I maintained my healing as described in the doctor's report, having received a total turnaround in results, having no activated signals, how I put together the report that I believe contributed largely to my enjoying a special protected status today. So I put that entire packet that I showed you and sent it through directly to Donald Trump while, you know, this was on his campaign trail. And then when he came into office, I had someone else communicate, and it actually made it to him. And that's why I'm allowed to talk today, because I've been put in a protected status. Otherwise, I would have been probably dead by now. you'll hear from part of my inner core group and how I became a private American citizen, and how you also can attain this status or status like it in your own country by returning to your original status at birth as non-surety and non-enemy. In other words, I'll get into that. You will see evidence that categorizes and marks us all as unwittingly and unknowingly threats to military databases and how to make corrections to that record. I encourage you above all to never forget who you are on this journey to healing and freedom. So this is all together about almost close to 11 and a half to 12 hours. This is 6 hours. This is 6 hours, give or take 5.5 hours. And I just basically release everything about what I did from the legal reports, from everything that I did to find a way to get out of being targeted. Now, I'm still targeted, okay, but I'm not a victim. And if they had their way, they would definitely, you know, continue in their path to continuing to make my life miserable. And they are, just like you, Jan. It ain't right what's going on. Carrie Cassidy just emailed me earlier telling me, I tried to click onto your website and it sends me somewhere else. And then I had VLTV tell me, your website, your link.
My website or your website?
Mine.
Okay.
My website was being jacked with. And so VLTV is angry. They're beside themselves because they're like, wait a minute. So my website had been jacked.
Make sure you don't, you know, it sounds like you got a virus on your website. My website had been hacked many times. Let's see, about this time last year, I had to pay, you know, it's like $225 a year to have a firewall on the website. And that's dramatically reduced the problems I've had. I just had to pay it again like a week ago to, you know, a few days ago to have it renewed. It's pricey. And, you know, you also have some images that aren't showing on your website. So,
interesting.
You know,
okay.
You have some missing image links that show on your website. So you probably want to get that fixed too. But I would probably, you know, try to put it behind a firewall if you can afford it. You know, thanks to people who donated for me being able to pay for getting a firewall up. There was a while there where I would get my website clean and put back up, and then, you know, it would get knocked down within 24 hours, 48 hours. And then, you know, so I called, you know, my site's on GoDaddy, probably a terrible host, but at least what most people say. But I'm on the phone with them, and they're going through finding all of the infected pages for me. You know, and, you know, spending like several hours on the phone with them looking for all of the, you know, infections and hacks and things that they would use to take down my website, you know. And one year I was watching all of these hackers streaming out of the dark web, you know, and I started looking up. I found where the servers were and I would look them up, and they were like Tor servers, you know, for this dark web. You know, and it's like, oh, okay. You know, I think I even have some of the emails saved that I emailed the owner of one of these Tor servers, and he, like, blasts. I tell him, you know, knock this crap off. What are you guys doing? And what he does is he takes my emails and blasts them out to his whole news list to get more people in on attacking me.
Oh, my.
And I'm pretty sure I saved all of this guy's emails, you know, but it was just like, wow. All right, Carrie, that's probably a good place to stop for tonight. Maybe we can have you back on sometime and do this again, go into other areas of exploration.
Mm-hmm.
And great show tonight. I really appreciate your time. You're a very interesting woman, and you know, you obviously get what's going on. And thank you, everyone, for your support tonight. Please go to logosmedia.com, logosmedia.com. And that's where you'll find this interview. Please show your support and click the donate contribute button there. Greatly appreciate everybody's support. I can't do it without you. And anyway, we will see you next week. I believe Lloyd will be on next week to continue with part 6 on Islam. So that will be a great show. And that's it, everyone. Have a good night and take care. Much love. Bye-bye.